This fall saw the resolution of a couple of long-running disputes in the museum world. After almost a century, a trove of contested Inca artifacts will travel from Yale back to Peru. Hiram Bingham, an explorer backed by Yale and a model for the character of Indiana Jones, took the artifacts from the ruins of the fabled Inca citadel Machu Picchu. Along similar lines, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York has agreed to return 19 relics from the tomb of the pharaoh Tutankhamun to Egypt. British explorer and archaeologist Howard Carter took them after he discovered King Tut's tomb in 1922. Egyptian and Peruvian governments have long argued that these objects were rightfully theirs, but that's exactly the kind of thinking that James Cuno, president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago, questions. In his book, Who Owns Antiquity? Museums and the Battle Over Our Ancient Heritage, he argues that antiquities are the cultural property of all humankind because they're evidence of the world's past and not that of a particular modern nation. We spoke to James in 2008. His book is now out in paperback with a new afterword. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. And we began by saying that this must be a difficult time to make this case when the culture seems to be saying, return objects to where they were found.
Well, it is, I think, and it's promoted as well by some of our most august international organizations. And UNESCO, for example, has been organizing a number of international conferences promoting the return of cultural property to its countries of origin. And that's based on the presumption that these objects have particular meaning to some particular people and ought to be with those particular people independent of how they might have been acquired or the meaning they have in the context in which they're currently seen.
Well, let's give an example. You write you happened to be in Rome when an ancient bowl was returned to Italy by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. First of all, tell us about the bowl, the Euphronius crater. Have I said that correctly?
Yes, that's correct, the Euphronius crater. It's an ancient Greek pot that was made by a Greek potter named Eusithius and the Greek painter Euphronius. It's signed by Euphronius. And it was made for the robust commerce between Greece and Etruria, which is an ancient culture in the northern part of the peninsula that is now today Italy.
Well, see, there it is. You've just described something that's Greek, and yet it was returned to Italy.
It's an interesting point that you make, and not only with this pot do we see evidence in which Greek culture was profoundly present on the peninsula that is now Italy, before the rise of Rome, and then even after the rise of Rome.
Well, but don't the Italians have a point that it's the land they live on now? So it's sort of, you know, a birthright in that it's of their land. Wouldn't Americans also feel the same way about, Indian artifacts that were kept in another museum overseas, or parts of the U.S. that were French, for instance, you know, before the Revolution? Wouldn't, if things were taken from the land, isn't that a point?
I'm not arguing that these things that are found within the jurisdiction of the modern nation state shouldn't also be identified with that modern nation state in some way. I think not quite in that long racial, ethnic, cultural way that some modern nations want that identity to be shaped or formed, but rather I'm arguing for the sharing, the broadening of this as something that would promote understanding around the world.
In fact, you call these laws that nations have to keep their cultural property within the boundaries of their country. You call these, you know, nationalist, retentionist cultural property laws. That's what they do. They retain their things. And you say these laws work against the ideals of the encyclopedic museum. Yours is one, the Art Institute of Chicago. What's an encyclopedic museum? And why is that more of a problem for those museums when things are retained?
Well, the encyclopedic museum, the origins of it lie in the Enlightenment. It's the idea of the museum as a repository of things dedicated to the dissemination of learning and to the museum's role as a force for understanding and tolerance. It is the idea that under one roof one can have representative examples of the world's diverse artistic cultures for the benefit of promoting understanding of culture as always hybrid, as always mongrel, as always bearing the imprint of contact with new and strange and wonderful things. It's the idea that we can learn more about the multiple narratives of our human ancestors on this planet by bringing them into contact with each other, and we can in the process promote greater understanding of the current conditions within which we live on this planet.
Well, an obvious point is that if you have all of these things juxtaposed under one roof, someone can see them, whereas if they were all in separate countries, you'd have to either live there or travel there to see them. But it seems as if there has to be a little quid pro quo here, because you write that these encyclopedic museums are a good idea, which means they're a good idea everywhere, which means that you know, museums like yours have to share.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's just exactly the point. What must be adjusted, it seems to me, is not the principle of the encyclopedic museum, but the balance of power and economic forces in the world. And we know that that's happening. It's going to be a different world 100 years from now, and we can take advantage of this realignment to promote this idea of understanding.
But James Cuno, isn't this an easier theory to hold as a Westerner? You know, for countries that have been plundered, that have seen things that, for instance, were religious items end up in museums as artifacts, isn't it harder for them to accept this, let's all share this material, than it is for someone in a Western museum?
Well, I'm not sure that why that should be the case.
Because they were the plundered, and most Western museums have been the archaeologists or the colonizers or the imperialists. You know.
I wouldn't make the easy equation between archaeologists and imperialists, or between.
Well, I'm not. I'm differentiating. I'm saying those are different ways that items got into Western museums.
Where they have been, of course, preserved and studied and presented to the world that is increasingly mobile right now, in which there are some millions of people living outside the country of their birth currently in this age of new globalization. That said, I'm sure it is easier for me to say so. It doesn't mean that it's wrong for me to say so, mm-hmm. but it might be easier for me to say so and to make the case. We also know that those people all value access to current products of manufacture produced globally, whether they be automobiles, iPhones, radios, whatever they might be, and we ought to find a way to share our ancient past equally.
Well, you make another point that not all peoples live in their homelands and don't get to see artifacts because in some places they're politicized, aren't they? I mean, this gives an opportunity for some people who have been shut out of their homeland to see things from their homeland.
We can certainly see that throughout the world, that there are people who have sought refuge and new beginnings in new places who deserve to have access not just to the new things, but the old things, which they might identify as, for example, Nigerians living in Chicago. But that could be said also of Chinese or Indians living in Africa, living in Australia. It is a fact that since we left East Africa some 60,000 years ago, we have sought new opportunities, and with new opportunities, we have come across new and strange and wonderful things and have made culture as a result of it.
That's James Cuno, president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago. His book, Who Owns Antiquity, is now out in paperback. Well, before we go, interactive radio.
It came upon a midnight clear.
Next week, we'll be taking a look back at what some call the best Christmas ever, Christmas 1945. World War II was over, the national Christmas tree blazed to life after years of darkness. If you or maybe your parent or grandparent has memories, maybe photos, home movies from that Christmas, please share them at hereandnow.org. Also, hacktivist, cubiquette, that's etiquette for the cubicle. Both are words that were born in 2010. We want to know your thoughts on the best words of 2010. Now, listeners are chiming in at hereandnow.org. I like Jeff Voss's contribution, screenager. These are teens who live online. Well, we'd love your thoughts. Just go to hereandnow.org. The links are on the right-hand side of the page. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.